And my task today, which I share with Steve Pisani, is to give you a status report on what President Nixon refers to as a generation of peace. I must say at the, at the outset that I regard this description of our times as thoroughly misleading. A generation of peril would be, I think, a more accurate description of the period between stretching from now to the end of this century. Let me begin my status report, however, with a reference to an essay by Dr. Urban Whitaker, Jr., first published in this city in 1960. Dr. Whitaker, at that time, was a member of the International Relations Department of San Francisco State University. And in his essay, he predicted that the United States would be a second-class power before many years, and he found the prospect pleasing. Indeed, Dr. Whitaker was enthusiastic about what he regarded as the inevitable diminishment of U.S. power, saying, and I quote, "The power that we are losing is, in many ways, the power to commit mistakes. By being weak enough to have to listen to others, we are being saved from ourselves." I found this essay by Urban Whitaker both arresting and appalling. He was not a Marxist critic of our society, but he clearly longed for the United States to be a nation of smaller stature and influence. He was, in other words, a forerunner of those who, as Joseph Alsop has written, are deathlessly devoted to a policy of national weakness. At the time, I was concerned that this outlook existed in our country, but I did not imagine that it would spread rapidly or shape the actions of our government. I have no reason to believe that Dean Rusk or Henry Kissinger were among those who did read Urban Whitaker's essay, but the policy that the United States, the policies the United States has followed since 1961, and the policies being carried out today by Secretary of State Kissinger, are the policies of Urban Whitaker of San Francisco State College or University, or at least the policies that he hoped for. These policies undoubtedly will fulfill Dr. Whitaker's prophecy that by the 21st century, we will probably have less to say in world affairs than some of our global neighbors. So this is the condition in which we find ourselves today. We have not been reduced to a position of impotence, far from it, but we have lost the commanding position as a world power which we had in the 1950s. And I hold that the policies that are supposed to produce a generation of peace, in fact, increase the peril to our people and endanger their security and future well-being. On August 8, 1968, then-candidate Richard Nixon vowed to, quote, "restore the strength of America so that we shall always negotiate from strength and never from weakness." He said that Americans face the stark truth that we are worse off in every area of the world than we were when President Eisenhower left office 8 years ago. He promised a complete house cleaning of those responsible for the failures of those 8 years. But I think that the record shows that there has been a continuity of anti-nationalist foreign policy from 1961 through today. That our country in 1974 is worse off in every area of the world than it was in 1969, and that we have suffered a further erosion of strength rather than undergone the restoration of strength vowed by Mr. Nixon. Since the opening of the 1960s, the United States has had a succession of anti-nationalist, anti-defense policy planners. There is an almost unbroken continuity of outlook between Robert McNamara in the Kennedy-Johnson years to Henry Kissinger in the Nixon era. They and the circles of policymakers and media and intellectual supporters around them have created the conditions of national weakness that Dr. Whitaker longed for, and not a stable world or a generation of peace. Now, consider the fundamental military facts of our national situation. In SALT I, Dr. Kissinger agreed to a formula whereby the Soviet Union acquired an advantage of some 40% in intercontinental ballistic missiles, the same edge in missile launching submarines, and a 30% advantage in submarine-launched ballistic missiles. In accepting this plan, which gave the Soviet Union a staggering military advantage, Dr. Kissinger was carrying on the McNamara policy of peace through U.S. weakness. It was Mr. McNamara, after all, who halted U.S. missile submarine construction as the Soviets pushed ahead. It was McNamara who opposed a nuclear power program for America's surface fleet, a program which, if it had been carried through, would have given the United States a tremendous advantage in this era of the Arab oil weapon. The Nixon-Kissinger talk about a generation of peace stands exposed, I think, as sham when one bears in mind the concessions that have been made to America's very formidable adversary, the Soviet Union. And I'd like to quote the words of Professor John Erickson of Edinburgh University, one, in my opinion, one of the ablest analysts of the Soviet armed forces. Writing in Strategic Review, he said of SALT I, I quote, "More than one Soviet strategist and military planner must still be rubbing his eyes in order to make sure that he is not, after all, dreaming. Whichever way they are read, the two basic documents on arms limitation, the anti-ballistic missile treaty and the interim agreement on offensive arms, can only be construed as heady encouragement for the USSR, as a sign that in demonstrable fashion a major strategic adversary has been successfully challenged for all the world to see." For the President and the Secretary of State to speak of a generation of peace in the context of this setback, I think, is worse than sham. It is hypocrisy. SALT I set up the conditions for a generation of threats, nuclear blackmail, and increased Soviet pressure and intimidation on every front. It is not only in military terms that the Nixon-Kissinger policies have resulted in new weakness. The administration's foreign policy involves a dismissal of the moral fact in America's relations with the Soviet Union and Communist China. Clearly, the U.S. has to deal with the Communist powers on many questions, but I believe that Mr. Nixon and Dr. Kissinger have compromised our moral integrity in their overdone friendliness with the leaders in Moscow and Peking. As Sidney Hook once advised, moral integrity in extreme situations is often the highest political wisdom. And given the moral obtuseness of Mr. Nixon and Dr. Kissinger in dealing with Brezhnev and Mao, one must wonder what the content would be of a generation of peace as defined by the President and the Secretary of State. Now, I do not suggest that all people share our ideas of peace with freedom, that all peoples are equally fitted or eligible for liberty in American or European terms. But the so-called detente devised with the Soviets would close the door on freedom for half of ancient Europe, the source of our civilization. In the Far East, there has been a manifest willingness to betray the interests of the Chinese on Taiwan to the regime in Peking. On the mainland, we may properly ask, therefore, in the Nixon-Kissinger generation of peace, what principle or nation will not be compromised or surrendered in order to get a paper agreement proclaiming peace? I am not suggesting that President Nixon should have adopted a rigid moralistic design for American foreign relations. I am simply concerned at the apparent willingness of the President and the Secretary of State to yield up the interests of those nations which have been good allies and which are committed to our values. The Nixon administration has erred, as the two previous administrations erred, in that it regards itself as having a mandate and a goal of universal peace, a species of liberal millenarianism. Indeed, this is the goal that was pursued by the falsely labeled best and the brightest of the Kennedy-Johnson administrations. I don't find sufficient evidence to conclude that the Nixon-Kissinger goal in foreign policy is the strict, traditional goal of protecting the interests and assuring the future survival of the United States. I don't find any tremendous concern for buttressing the United States by maintaining solidarity with key allies committed to the same civilizational goals. If Dr. Kissinger were primarily concerned with U.S. security, how could he propose that the United States surrender control of the Panama Canal to the strongman regime in power in that country? Why, one may ask, has Dr. Kissinger had no compunction about alienating America's NATO allies in the arms talks for the Soviet Union? Why did Dr. Kissinger, in fact, close his eyes to the politically significant Chinese communist aggression in the Paracel Islands recently? While these islands have no great strategic significance, America's failure to react strongly was, I think, a signal to Asia's communists that the United States has changed greatly from the days of firm action in the Formosa Strait. that the United States will accept and acquiesce in Peking's aggressive moves. And while I'm hardly an admirer of the Washington Post, I think the Post put it correctly when it said of the Paracel affair that the U.S. was, quote, tacitly acquiescing in the Chinese conquest. There's really not much more for the rest of us to do but to learn the Paracel's Chinese name. What we have today, I submit to you, is not the beginning of a generation of peace, but an era of acquiescence to the communist powers on almost every, all major issues. It was only by the most extraordinary good fortune that Chile escaped from communist rule. But for the determined Chileans, Dr. Kissinger might be down there today instead of in Mexico City, where he's been vowing to open a new era of cooperation between the United States and a communist Chile and outlining economic aid and cultural exchanges, undoubtedly after secret negotiations with the Chilean communist leadership, as he has conducted secret negotiations with other foes of the United States. I stress the secret character of the negotiations because in the Nixon-Kissinger years, the United States has moved away from its traditional pattern of diplomacy. Only a very tiny circle of people in our government are involved in Dr. Kissinger's global negotiations. There has been no real disclosure of the nature of the commitments and the trade-offs made by the President and his Secretary of State. And we must bear in mind, I think, that Dr. Kissinger looms more and more as an independent force in foreign policy decision-making in view of the grave domestic weakness of the President. And I also believe that those who question the generation of peace concept have a right to suspect that Dr. Kissinger is purchasing peace on the terms offered by the Soviet Union and Communist China. Only in the case of the diplomacy involving the future of the Panama Canal do the American people get a clear view of the concession Dr. Kissinger has offered, namely a concession of U.S. sovereignty there. And it is only because a treaty is involved that the American people gain this inside view of a Kissinger diplomatic package. And I suspect that in time we shall find that other dangerous and outrageous concessions have been made in the course of arriving at international agreements. Certainly we know what the U.S. has turned away from during the Nixon-Kissinger direction of foreign policy. For 20 years, the United States developed a remarkably open alliance system, especially in the Atlantic world, in which anti-communist nations were given abundant opportunities for consultation and regularly constituted meetings. No doubt changes were necessary in the arrangements of the NATO alliance, for example, because of changes in the relative status of Europe and America. But the alliance system helped preserve freedom for a considerable number of years, and it could have been modified or amended and continued to offer opportunities for mutual defense and strengthening. But President Nixon allowed Dr. Kissinger to bypass America's friends and partners in Europe and to deal above their heads with the Soviet leaders, with the leaders who want to put West Europe in thraldom and who are opposed to every feature of Western civilization. In so doing, Mr. Nixon and Dr. Kissinger struck fear into the West European nations, caused them to feel betrayed and cruelly exposed. This, I am sure, did not contribute to the building of a generation of peace. Quite the contrary. It has caused the West European nations to think about how they might salvage their security in a world in which the superpowers treated them as pawns. Is it any wonder, therefore, that France chooses to go its own way in negotiating for the oil that it must have? In another area, the evidence strongly suggests that the detente policy is a step in the direction of disaster. I refer to the use of America's economic power and technological expertise as peace offerings to the Soviet Union. It is amazing that the generation of peace and detente rhetoric has been so widely accepted. Last year, when the Soviets were hungry and had a grave crop failure, the United States sent them wheat. This year, we face an energy crisis, and the Soviets have helped shut off the oil needed by the U.S. and its friends around the world. The administration persists, nevertheless, in encouraging sales to the Soviet Union, not only of foodstuffs, which drive up food prices at home, but of the advanced technology that can be used to give the USSR advantages in both civilian and military areas. Control Data Corporation, for example, has been allowed to sign a 10-year agreement with the USSR Council of Ministers for Science and Technology for the development of advanced computer systems. And all these systems have military applications in a society where every segment of the economy is military-related. Obviously, this is too wide a field to discuss in this brief time, But I commend to you the testimony of Benjamin Schemmer, editor of Armed Forces Journal International, before the House Subcommittee on International Cooperation in Science and Space. This was on December 5. He put the detente folly in perspective when he said that we are continuing, euphorically, a, and I quote, wholesale auction of advanced technology to a nation which not only cares enough to steal the very best, but which could, over the long haul, use American technology, bought at bargain basement prices, to hurt American interests through further adventurism in places like Korea, Vietnam, and the Middle East, or to hurt our own economy. It is no wonder, therefore, that many American conservative thinkers speak, as does Professor Henry Paolucci of St. John's University, of the suicidal Kissinger policy. The existence of this policy has cruelly disappointed those Americans who hoped and believed that President Nixon's years in office would lead to a restoration of depleted national strength and to a more vigorous defense of the national interest. But the president seems persuaded that the United States can do with less power, that it can yield positions of strength held during what he once referred to as the era of confrontation, all without our adversaries seeking to maximize their power and without our enemies determining to occupy the positions of power vacated by the United States. As for Dr. Kissinger, I can only conclude that he is a man who approaches our nation's existence and future from a wholly theoretical standpoint, a man who has little grasp of this country's life and historical experience, no sense of the inner drives and mental qualities of our people west of the Hudson River, no feeling for the struggles and sacrifices associated with the settlement and filling out of this continent. What does Dr. Kissinger believe in his heart? One possibility, it seems to me, is that he believes, as Stephen Rosenfeld has suggested in the Washington Post, that the United States lacks not only the military means, but the worth or the stomach for a role as the number one world power, and should accept contritely, in the name of realism, peace or detente, whatever diminishments come to itself or its friends. A second possibility is that Dr. Kissinger truly believes that no unpleasant consequences will follow from diminishment of U.S. power or acquiescence in Soviet designs, that the Soviet Union today is essentially a status quo nation which can be counted on to avoid attempting to exploit local situations from which Western power has withdrawn. In conclusion, let me say that among ordinary Americans there is little of the shallow utopianism that is necessary to produce a promise of a generation of peace. I think that realistic Americans, at least in the past, largely subscribe to the idea that strife is a permanent condition, and that it is absurd to expect this country to avoid conflict and danger, especially at a time when one finds on the world scene aggressive nations, Soviet Union and Communist China, that are determined to undermine and eliminate our national power, our civilizational institutions, our loyalties, and our fundamental concepts of life. The way out of the problems created by our foreign policy planners in the 1960s and the early 1970s obviously will be enormously difficult. We must start, I am convinced, by helping our fellow citizens face the unpalatable fact that the promise of a generation of peace is a dangerous myth that makes us ignore our growing peril.